Hello, and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today we begin a brand new show format. I'm very, very excited to bring this to you. It has been in my creative mind for about 6 to 9 months now, and it's finally coming to fruition. Please be patient with me as I work through the tweaks that I'm sure I will need to do as we go along. But we have four incredibly wise souls, and we start off our show today. I'm going to first talk about all four guests, and then I'm going to bring on my first guest. And today we're talking and focusing upon the paranormal, how it's viewed, coming out of a male perspective and opening up the right intuitive feminine aspect of the brain, and looking for balance in our lives, looking for that harmony, that peace that we can create through where we put our attention and where we can put our thoughts. Today we are going to enjoy four wonderful guests, like I had said, and we're going to start off our hour with James D. Stein, who wrote The Paranormal Equation. He's both an author and a professor, and he also wrote How Math Explains the World. He's a fascinating man, and he's going to talk to us about the new scientific perspective on remote viewing, clairvoyance, and other inexplicable phenomena. Then we are moving into a little dialogue with Don Mortesini, as he talks about, who's also an author, and he is a psychotherapist, and he's going to talk about how the East and the West view paranormal phenomena. And then we are moving into another segment with Charles Edward, who is a life transformational coach and inspirational speaker, and he's going to talk about male vulnerability and what that looks like. And we end our segment with Terry Cochran, who is going to be offering us some wisdom and insight as a certified nutritionist, as a health and healthy segment for herbs and food. So without further ado, I bring your attention to my first wonderful guest, and this is James D. Stein, PhD, author of The Paranormal Equation, also author of How Math Explains the World. And as I said, we're going to be discussing how a new scientific perspective is coming to our awareness on remote viewing and clairvoyance. So welcome, James Stein. I am so very, very happy to have you on my show today. Welcome,
Lisa. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
This is wonderful. I loved your book. I love the combination of science and mysticism. And this is, you know, you take for someone who was probably raised with such an analytical perspective, you really do combine the intuitive perspective so geniusly in your book. You have such a weaving that I just love to read. And without further ado, let's get into this math as the universal language. We hear this so many times, that math is the universal language of the world, and I tend to believe that. But why do you think that is, in regard to certain scientists that have been pioneers in the study of patterns and numbers, and why would we look at math in that way?
Well, I think that it is true that math is a universal language, but I don't think it's the universal language in that there's stuff that math simply doesn't explain. What math is really good at is it's dealing with stuff that can be measured or which you can ascribe certain objective qualities to, like shape and things like that. And because our universe consists so much of relationships between things that can be measured or things that have shapes and change into different shapes, that's, I think, the reason that mathematics is so effective in expressing and dealing with these quantities of the universe. But it's just not perfect in dealing with everything. There are limitations to math, as there are limitations to all forms of knowledge.
Right. Now, what scientists were instrumental in looking at the patterns and numbers as something that should be explored more in regard to phenomena?
Well, I think you could probably say that of practically every science that deals with measurement, because if you take a look at what are the great laws that science has discovered, and we're talking about things like Newton's law of universal gravitation or Einstein's theory of relativity or Maxwell's theories of electromagnetism, they're expressed in terms of quantities and their relationships to each other. And it usually requires a lot of work on the part part of many members of the scientific community to arrive at a theory which expresses these relationships. And you sort of get the impression when you take a course in science or when you look at one of the TV shows discussing these things that these people are sort of like Beethovens or Picassos, and all of a sudden inspiration comes to them. And it does in some sense, but it's a more linear process than that. It's a matter of putting together all the arduous experiments that have gone into trying to see what happens when you do something to something. That's the basic experiment, started maybe with Galileo when he rolled balls down an inclined plane and tried to see how they picked up speed and measured how long it took them to get from one place to another in order to see if they changed their velocities and if he could find a pattern to it. And Kepler, who was one of the great astrologers of his day, believe it or not, looked for patterns in the orbits of the planets about the sun and tried to figure out how that could be fit into some sort of universal pattern. So this is basically what science, or at least the quantitative sciences, is about.
Okay. Now, what did what would you say is the borderline between a natural phenomenon and a supernatural phenomenon?
That's an extremely good question, because there's a difficulty with saying what is supernatural when, if you take a look at our past history, things that are natural to us would have been supernatural to generations before. Certainly the mere fact that you and I are talking by from one end of the continent to another, or we can look at TV and see pictures that come from practically anywhere, would have appeared to be supernatural to someone from the 15th century. So what happens is that science tends to push back the domain of the supernatural. But I think the really interesting question is, are there things that we will never know? And not only there are there things that we will never know, but things that we would expect science to be able to explain to us, things like relationships between the physical parameters that we measure, such as mass, length, time, energy, force, information. Are there relationships between this that are going to be forever unknown, not because we just haven't enough time to investigate it, but because in some sense we simply cannot access this knowledge? And I think that's where the supernatural lies, in knowledge that we cannot access. And it's only in the 20th century that we were able to establish that there really is such a thing as knowledge that we cannot access.
Okay. And that brings me to a question that I'd love to hear your perspective on. In regard to dark matter and dark energy, what is this, and how is this relevant?
Well, I think it's relevant because what we've discovered, startlingly enough, in the last 20 years or 30 years, is that the universe that we thought we know, we only really know 5% of it. Dark matter is sort of a pat name for matter that we know exists because it affects the rotation rates of stars and galaxies, but we can't detect it, or at least we haven't detected yet. It's dark to all our instruments. We can't see it. Our X-ray detectors don't pick it up. Our gamma ray detectors don't pick it up. Our microwave detectors don't pick it up. So far it's dark and we don't know what it is. And dark energy is even more startling because approximately 11 or 12 years ago, we discovered that the universe is actually accelerating in its expansion. Rather than slowing down as you might expect, it's expanding ever more rapidly. And this expansion is due to something that we call dark energy, simply because we have no idea what it is. I think it was described to be dark energy simply because we already had the idea of dark matter, and this was an energy and it formed a natural linguistic pair, dark matter, dark energy. But the startling thing is that the universe turns out to consist of about 5% ordinary matter and energy, 20% dark matter, and the rest dark energy. In other words, we don't know what 95% of the energy is. It's a great, and 95% of the stuff in the universe. And that's a great mystery. And until that mystery is solved, there are things that, you know, that we want to say about the universe that were absolutely stymied.
Right. That's incredible. Do you feel that parallel universes exist somewhere within this matter, or if that's going to be something that scientists are able to prove at some point?
Oh, I certainly do, and I think an awful lot of scientists believe that parallel universes exist, and they can exist in one of several ways. There's, I would recommend to your readers and your listeners that if they want to go on the internet and Google a man named Max Tegmark, T-E-G-M-A-R-K. He wrote an absolutely beautiful article on parallel universes for Scientific American back in 2003. And basically he makes clear that it's orthodox scientific thinking in a number of ways that parallel universes exist. And he describes it very, very matter-of-factly by saying, because it was an article that he wrote in a magazine, he said that at this moment, a long distance from you, there's a person exactly like you sitting in a chair reading exactly the same article that you are, and the only difference between you and him is that when you get to this sentence, you continue reading, and he stops and goes off and gets a cup of coffee. It's very orthodox scientific thinking to believe in parallel universes.
Wow, that's incredible. So actually, there is going to most likely be some revealings in the next century that has befuddled all of us for many centuries, is what you say.
I think that's the history of all the sciences, and it's actually the history of all knowledge. I mean, I think that, science, you know, we tend to see science advance and can measure it more accurately simply because, number one, is it's easier to put the laws of science down than, say, the laws of human interaction. It's much easier to measure temperature or electricity than it is to measure wisdom or compassion. So that means that science has a leg up simply because it deals with stuff that's a lot easier to measure, number one. And number two is that there's a huge payoff in learning about the universe. We can make lives better for ourselves. You look at everything that exists today. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would far rather be me, a relatively ordinary math professor living in a suburb of Los Angeles in the year 2013, than I would have liked to have been the richest person in the world in the year 1900, because if you were the richest
right.
person in the world in 1900, your life expectancy wouldn't have been so great. A trip to the dentist would have been agonizing, and what could you do for entertainment other than see an occasional play, listen to some music, or read a book?
Right, right. Good point. That's a great point. Would you say that there are... that science is looking into the aspect of ghosts or apparitions or spirits to see if they actually do exist? And what do you think science would say about that if they did prove that?
Well, there have been instances in which legitimate scientists, and when I think of legitimate scientists, I think of people who have, you know, solid scientific credentials, have
right.
looked into such a thing as spirituality, ghosts, after death experiences. But I think part of the difficulty is that you can't measure or describe these things objectively as well as you can much of the stuff that science deals with, things like temperature and electricity. But I think that, you know, that the study of ghosts is not performed by scientists generally at the moment for a really simple reason. There's no money in it. Scientists, like everybody else, need to eat. They need to put a roof over their heads. And they also need expensive equipment. And the people who usually put money up for scientists to work, or governments and corporations. And if you were to ask a government, well, suppose that a scientist discovered that ghosts are a reality, how's it going to help the government, you know, how's it going to help them, the politicians who funded it, get elected? And if you ask a corporation to put up money to study it, what product are they going to produce that they're going to sell? They'd much rather investigate things such as cure for cancer or cheaper sources of energy, which are going to do everybody some good. But one thing I do feel fairly certain of, if ghosts are ever shown to be a reality, in the same way that electricity or temperature or something like that is a reality, or even the social sciences, the realities that we deal with in psychology and sociology and things like that, if ghosts ever achieve that level of reality, there'll be departments of ghostology in the science departments of major universities, because scientists love to study reality. That's their thing. Mm-hmm. But you got to show them that it really is reality first.
Right, right. And do you feel like science will become more tolerant of unscientific viewpoints as we move along here?
Well, yes and no, because science is a human endeavor, and mm-hmm. there's usually an establishment in every human endeavor, even the intellectual one, such as science. And what happens is the people who are at the top of the heap have gotten to the top of the heap because they have a particular viewpoint, and when you challenge that viewpoint, what happens is that you're essentially going up against the top guns in the field. And the people who are established want to preserve their standing. So because it's a human enterprise, there's still going to be a certain amount of intolerance. And in a way, that intolerance is beneficial to the world as a whole, because in order for something to be established as scientific knowledge, it's got to pass some pretty rigorous tests. And that's good for us, because it means that you can build on these things. It's sort of like designing a new type of airplane. They now do that all by computers, and you don't really have to fly actual airplanes to know that they're going to fly, because the theory is sufficiently good that you can design it on a computer and be pretty sure that it's not going to crash when you take it off. And this is a tremendous advance, and it's the type of thing that science relies upon. When you have solid knowledge, you can build upon it. So
even though
there will always be challenges to the status quo, and I think that's true of any human endeavor, and it's beneficial that there are challenges, because otherwise science becomes dogma rather than the pursuit of knowledge. But the fact is that because the people who are at the top are human beings, they like being at the top, they got to the top by espousing certain ideas which have proven to be true. If you challenge them, you're going to have to be right. But if you are right, they're going to accept you, and you're going to be the new members of the establishment.
Right. And how would you say that precognition and psychokinesis is different from ESP and telepathy, and even clairvoyance?
Well, I think the difficulty is precognition runs into the difficulty that there are logical problems associated with it. If you think you get a message from the future, you could take an action which would invalidate that. Like, let's say you got a message that you were going to have a traffic accident on a freeway tomorrow night. So you stay off that particular road, you don't have a traffic accident. You've invalidated the message. So that's a logical problem that precognition has to overcome. And as for psychokinesis, in order to move stuff or do anything on the psychokinetic front, you run into various physical laws that require forces. And the forces that we know, gravity and electromagnetism and the nuclear forces, those are ones which have been well studied, and they deteriorate with distance. They weaken with distance. And mental forces presumably don't, and we haven't detected them yet. They may exist. It's possible, but as of yet, there's no definitive evidence. As for ESP and telepathy, ESP, surprisingly enough, there was a study done of college professors in the 1990s, and more than 50% of the science professors believed that ESP was either an established reality or very likely. And I don't know of a similar study that has been done for telepathy, but my personal feeling, and this is just a personal feeling, is that at some time in the future, telepathy will be achieved mechanically, if nothing else, simply because when we think about things, electrochemical patterns form in our brains. These influence the surrounding environment, even if minutely, and we're getting better and better detectors, and they'll be able to pick up these changes in the environment. And then it's a matter of finding the Rosetta Stone, which associates these changes with the thoughts in our brain. But at the start of your show, you talked about right-brained people and left-brained people. We didn't know that until we had, you know, until we had neuroscience and the technology to investigate what the association was between left-brain thinkers and right-brain thinkers. And as our technology gets better, we'll get better at associating various portions of the brain with specific thoughts and thought patterns.
Right, and that's also coming out of a very masculine-based thinking and the analytical thought, because it's always inspiring to me when I start to see the balance of incorporating both hemispheres, because I do believe that both are needed for the balance of our being and the world, and I really appreciate that work that you do. Jim, it has been a wonderful segment to have you on as my guest. This has been really so inspiring. Where can my listeners get a hold of you? Or I want to also mention your book again, The Paranormal Equation. It is by James D. Stein, Ph.D. He is also the author of How Math Explains the World. He is author and professor, and he is... This is found on Amazon, is that right?
That's right. Jim? I mean, practically any book that's ever been written can be found on Amazon. But they can get in touch with me by emailing me, because I'm a paid employee of the state of California, and basically I'm paid to answer questions. So if you go to the website for California State University, Long Beach, go to the math department. There's only one Stein, that's me. There's an email address. And I've always said, if somebody asks me a question, if I know the answer, I'll tell them. If I think I know the answer, I'll tell them that I think I know the answer. If I only have an opinion, I'll tell them that. And if I'm clueless, I'll tell them that, too.
Wonderful. Jim, you have been a blessing of a guest. Thank you so much for being my guest today. I wish you a wonderful new 2013, and God bless. Thank you so much for bringing this insight to our attention today.
Lisa, thank you for inviting me again.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Take
care. Bye-bye. Now we're moving into my next segment, which is a second segment, and where our guest now is Don Mortesini. And Don is the author of Princes and Ogres, and he is also going to talk to us about how we look at the paranormal from the West versus how the paranormal is viewed from the East. And I would like to bring your attention now to my next guest, Don Mortesini, psychotherapist and author of Princes and Ogres. Don, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, it's great. You know, Lisa, it's great to just be on your show again. I just love it. And I really enjoyed the professor and made some notes on what he said. I'm just excited to get going.
Oh, thank you so much. You are always such a light. I love talking to you. You're such a you integrate such integrity with your work, and I truly, truly value that. So let's talk a little bit about the East and the West viewpoints.
Okay, yeah. I want to start with a statement he made, and he said that, you know, 95% of the universe is a mystery. And you asked him about studying paranormal phenomena, and he said, yes, but there are great difficulties, and we can only go so far. And
right. That
is because they use physical instruments of some kind to measure, and they're working with their intellect. And so what you and I are going to be talking about is not about using the intellect, by putting the intellect on hold, quieting the intellect so that we can delve into consciousness. And,
wonderful.
And so to begin with, in the East, starting 600 years B.C., the very first philosopher that developed a monism, that is, the concept of just one God, you know, may have different faces, it doesn't matter, Jesus, Jehovah, whatever, monism, his name was Kapila. And every philosopher, every thinker from that time forward in the East never made a distinction between something that is solid, between matter and spirit. So in the East, there is just two phenomena, if you will, and that is consciousness and energy. Everything is consciousness and energy. So what we call God is penultimate, infinite consciousness, and, of course, infinite energy. And your guest, you know, the professor is wonderful, will tell you that your eyes deceive you. Lisa, you and I are not solid.